Bath turn to God's word. I draw your attention to 2 Kings chapter 5. We will have a little break from the doings of Elisha. What we have here are fourth and final part of the episodes of Naaman. I keep having to stop myself from calling him Naaman the leper. He's not Naaman the leper. He's Naaman the ex-leper. 2 Kings chapter 5, and I'm going to read from verse 20. 2 Kings chapter 5, and I shall read from verse 20. Naaman has been healed. He's offered a great deal of wealth to Elisha. Elisha has declined it. Naaman has gone his merry way back to Syria to bring what I would call gospel light to that dark and pagan land. And then we come to the events of verse 20. Verse 20. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, "Look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian, while not receiving from his hands what he brought. But as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him." So Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" Let me pause there. There's already a contrast developing between Naaman the pagan, ex-pagan, and Gehazi the believer, whom I might call ex-believer. First of all, let's just examine Naaman. Naaman is on his way back to Syria, having been healed miraculously, freely, graciously, without having paid anything for it, is now on his way back to Syria, a changed man. That is what the living God does to people. He changes them. If you have never been changed by the living God, it's because you've never met him. Naaman met him in those waters of healing. Elisha was in one respect a little bit rude to him, but God wasn't. God was gracious to him in that healing. And he's going off to Syria now, no longer a pagan. In fact, we can detect a change of character in verse 21. Remember when Naaman was offended because he thought dipping in the River Jordan beneath him were not sufficiently complicated to heal such a great man as he, and that Elisha did not come to meet him in person. His pride was directing him. Look here though. Here is a servant running after the chariot, and we're told Naaman got down to meet him. This is a mighty Syrian general, a member of the Syrian aristocracy, and a man comes after him, whom he may well have recognized as a representative of Elisha. He stops the caravan or the cavalcade and gets down in person to meet him. This is the man who was angry that Elisha would not meet him in person. Now he steps down from his war chariot to greet the servant. There's been a change in him. Oh, you say, it's not a great change. It's change enough. Yeah. It's change enough. There is a humility in Naaman, even in the sorry episodes we are reading this morning. Well, there has perhaps been a change in Gehazi too. There has been the odd dark hint about Gehazi, but only a hint. We can see from verse 20, there is something very much wrong with his heart. He says, "I will run after him and take something from him." Elisha has refused the gold and silver, but Gehazi will take it in his stead. In fact, he even makes something of an oath, but as the Lord lives, he brings the Lord into it, perhaps to sanctify or accommodate his greed. Let us remember, of course, that Elisha, I don't think, lived like a king, and I don't suppose his servant fared any better. But the man or woman of God does not need to run after wealth, because they know that God will provide everything they need until the very minute of their death. And then when he calls them home, the poorest in heaven will be found to be far greater and richer than the greatest and richest on earth right now. In other words, we do not need to go chasing after money or prestige or promotion, because our God, who holds the cattle on a thousand hills and the wealth in every mine, is more than capable of looking after you, providing for your needs, and doing much more besides. However, what we have here in the heart of Gehazi is that most wicked opponent of genuine faith. It is the cunning plan. He has concocted, devised, formulated a way to get rich quick. Elisha has turned it down, but I will take what he has refused. Now, from a worldly point of view, he's acting wisely. Elisha, bless him, he's so heavenly minded, he forgets that we have bellies to fill. And after all, there have been times of famine quite recently. Would it not be appropriate to take at least a little bit of what Naaman offered and put it aside for a rainy day? After all, God helps those who help themselves. Have you heard that one before? Yeah, Hezekiah 15, verse 13. Don't go and look it up. Indeed. It's not true. God helps those who cannot help themselves. God helps those who know they cannot help themselves, not capable of helping themselves, and have come to the realization there is no help they can have except from the very grace of God. God saves people, not because they're good and deserving, but because they're not good and they are ill-deserving. We took communion just 10 minutes ago, that wonderful reminder, month after month, that we're saved by grace, not by works. None of us can boast. Gehazi has devised a clever way of enriching himself in this life. Naaman, bless him, asks the question in verse 21, is all well? In the heart of Gehazi, all is not well. There is a sickness at work in the heart of Gehazi that was more lethal and deadly than ever the leprosy suffered by Naaman. That leprosy was capable of killing the body, but the illness inside the heart of Gehazi will kill the soul. Verse 22, Gehazi said, all is well. My master has sent me, saying, indeed, just now, two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of garments. Is he telling the truth? Well, of course not. Gehazi must be credited with imagination. He basically invented a sob story. We know that the sons of the prophets are not wealthy men, and two have come from the mountains of Ephraim. That must have been a tough walk. And they really need a talent of silver. Oh, and 2 changes of garments, if that's not too much either. Because you know what, their clothes aren't very good, and of course you could give them 1 set of garments, but they would wear out. Maybe a spare one. A talent of silver, we know that you can afford it. Notice also that he invokes Elisha's name. He could have said, I want it for me. I don't think Elisha would have approved, but he wouldn't at least have been a liar. In fact, he brings Elisha into it. He pretends he's doing it to help 2 poor young men. And Naaman gives him more than he asks for. Verse 23. So Naaman said, please, take 2 talents. You wanted 1 talent, I'm going to give you 2. Is Naaman at fault here? No. Once again, he's showing his generosity. Now, when he brought the silver and gold the first time, prior to his healing, we might have said that was Naaman's way of buying salvation, of buying healing. And salvation and healing cannot be bought or sold. It's given freely, yes. It's received freely, or it's not received at all. It is, in fact, different here in verse 23. Naaman is offering the 2 talents of silver, not in order to get God's blessing, but as a simple act of kindness. To Naaman's credit, he is being generous when he will get nothing back. Another testimony, I think, that the grace of God has truly been at work in his heart. Despite the situation he has been thrust into, Naaman continues to inspire us. He is a man of God. Oh, it is his early days. His faith is immature. He is going to have many testing times ahead of him in that temple of fire. It's coming. But he's given a test right now. Now, we might say, if only he'd been a bit wiser. Why not make further inquiries? Why not ask for a written document saying that Elisha wants the money? Why not ask the names of the sons of the prophets who will receive this generous endowment? Yeah. We could criticise him for that, but I think it would be unjust. Naaman is so grateful for what God has done. Giving 2 talents of silver to 2 poor young men is no hardship to him. He urged him and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of garments and handed them to 2 of his servants, and they carried them on ahead of him. Well, Gehazi must have been rubbing his hands together with glee. Not only does he get more than he thought he would embezzle, but somebody else is carrying it back for him. Verse 24, when he came to the citadel, he took them from their hands and stored them away in his own house. Then he let the men go and they departed. I will pass the silver on to the 2 young men tomorrow. Don't let me keep you, please. You go back to Naaman. I'll take good care of it. Verse 25. Now he went in and stood before the master. Elisha said to him, where did you go, Gehazi? And he said, your servant did not go anywhere. What has Gehazi done wrong? The 10 Commandments are a good moral guide for all people in all times and all places. And sadly, they have exposed Gehazi for the person he truly is. Outwardly, he is the personal servant of a great man of God, Elisha. I imagine that gives him some authority. He's held in respect by true believers and perhaps a grudging respect by the pagans, I don't know. But the law has exposed him for what he truly is. The law says, do not covet. But he coveted one, if not two, bags of silver. Elsewhere, Elisha is called a father figure. He's addressed here as master, but in one respect, he's dishonoured his father, his spiritual father. Not only does he now fob him off, but he committed an act of fraud in Elisha's name. He's taken the Lord's name in vain. Verse 20. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. Why bring the holy name of the Lord into it? Why give his filthy plan of deception a spiritual veneer, a cover? He bears false testimony, lying to Naaman, lying to Elisha. I'm not wishing to stretch the point too far. I wonder if that silver, that wealth, was for Gehazi another god. You shall have no other gods before me. Few of us today will have a statue of this or a statue of that, but there are other things in our lives which we honour more than gods, which we desire more than God, which we will live for more than God. I wonder if the real God of Gehazi is contained in two little bags given to him from Naaman. Gehazi has succumbed to that terrible condition which many today also suffer. The worship of money. Elisha evidently has been told by the Spirit of God what has happened. I don't think he simply worked it out using logic. In the second part of verse 26, Elisha is aware of what Gehazi intends to do with the money. It's not to give clothes to two poor lads. Elisha knows that. The second sentence of that 26th verse, is it time to receive money and to receive clothing, olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? Elisha understands what Gehazi is planning to do with that money. And again, from an earthly, worldly point of view, he's not going to fritter it away on drink. He's going to buy a farm. Good. He's going to plant olives and vines, grapes, sheep, oxen. He's going to diversify. He knows how to do it. He is a sound investor of somebody else's money. Furthermore, he has made plans for a workforce, male and female servants. Gehazi is planning for retirement. And who can blame him? It might be, especially the reference to the servants there, that Gehazi has grown a little tired of taking Elisha's orders. He's looking forward to the day when actually he's the big boss. And the men and women come to him for instruction and guidance to receive the day's orders instead of Gehazi doing Elisha's bidding.
Was he wrong?
Well, yes, he defrauded the money.
Furthermore, this plan for a wonderful kind of life on the farmhouse veranda, was that also wicked? Well, not in itself. But the man or woman of God can and may enjoy the good things of this life. But they're not to live for them. Nor to die for them. Because they cannot be kept. And they're not worth keeping. It's true that Gehazi and possibly Elisha had a more limited view of heaven than we have. He had not the New Testament to read. He had not the book of Daniel to consider. I think they believed in an afterlife. They knew that Elijah had gone up in that chariot of fire. But even so, Gehazi knew that the God of Elisha had far more to offer him than sheep and oxen, olives and grapes. But look at that stinging rebuke in the first part of verse 26. Then he said to him, "Did not my heart go with you?" Gehazi is going to contract a terrible medical condition in verse 27, yet I wonder if those words in verse 26 offered his soul a greater sting than anything that leprosy gave him. "Did not my heart go with you? Was I not with you?" Is he just referring to the fact that he brings up Elisha's name and takes advantage of it? No, I don't think so. I think Elisha had a love for Gehazi. He was his confidant. The man whom he trusted to get things done. And in fact, he's used that position of authority to defraud, if I may use this phrase, a babe in Christ. Let's be honest. Let's move out of the Israelite Bronze Age and come to the times in which we live. Is it possible? Could it be true? Might it be the case that there are religious leaders today who are more interested in money grubbing than gospel preaching? Who care more for the insides of your wallet or your purse instead of whether your soul is right with God? Gehazi saw Naaman. As an opportunity to enrich himself. Furthermore, Naaman would inevitably be left with the impression that Elisha is fickle. He said he wasn't interested in my money, but then he changed his mind. The message was that I was to be healed freely. But oh, by the way, if you wouldn't mind giving some money to the ministry after all, it would be very gratefully received. And when he goes back to that Syrian king, Ben-Hadad II, And Ben-Hadad says, you've got an awful lot of gold and silver still with you. Did he heal you for free? Our prophets charge money. But that Israelite healed you for free. And Nathan says, well, it was nearly free. For 2 bags of silver and 2 changes of clothing, my leprosy was taken away. Praise the Lord. We don't know what reaction Gehazi received. And it might be that Naaman was able to separate the contribution towards the sons of the prophets, who of course weren't real, and handing over money for a healing. It might be that Naaman could tell the difference. I hope he could. But Gehazi represents that carnal, worldly Christianity, which fleeces the flock instead of feeding them. He is the religious leader who boasts about how much he gets paid. He is the religious leader who sees a Sunday morning service as a business opportunity, who sees that pastoral visit to your house as a networking opportunity, who sees that time spent preparing for a meeting as an investment. Did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you? It's almost as though Elisha was there. In fact, he says, my heart was with you. If Elisha is appalled by Gehazi's conduct, so much more I think the God of Elisha, whose reputation has also suffered because of this act of petty fraud. Verse 27, therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever. For he went out from his presence leprous, as white as snow. Now we might read that and think, oh dear, that's an overreaction. And yet in one respect, it's perfectly apt. The passage began with Gehazi lusting after something that belonged to Naaman. The passage ends with him receiving something that belonged to Naaman. If I was right all those weeks ago when we began chapter 5 and considered leprosy to be a picture, a spiritual picture of sin, then it's appropriate that Gehazi should now have it. Furthermore, his descendants will be affected by it as well. Perhaps not all of them, perhaps one in every generation. It's not clear. But just as Naaman went up to Syria to share gospel light, so Gehazi is now going to spread corruption and death among his people. For any who think it is an overreaction, I think it demonstrates just how grieved Elisha truly was. This was not a simple mistake, a little error, let's turn a blind eye to it. It effectively compromised the witness of Naaman to the whole of Syria. How many of us, when we're sharing our faith, are met with somebody who says something along the lines of, well,
I knew a pastor once and he was a hypocrite. I knew people who went to church and they were terrible. And sometimes it's just a cheap excuse not to engage you in further conversation. But sometimes, I'm sorry to say, they are absolutely right. And it might be that you're sitting here this morning and you've been put off Christ because of Christ's people. And I would say to you, look unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of your faith. Don't look to a pastor or a house group leader or a priest or a vicar or even an ordinary Christian. Because so often we err and we get things wrong. Look to him. And I trust and I pray that Naaman looked to the God of Elisha. Not the servant of Elisha. When he arrived back in Syria. May God bless his word to us this day.